Right, we're now on talk two in the series on Matthew's Gospel. And we had got last time until chapter 1, verse 17. We didn't get very far last time. And let me just add one extra point to what I was speaking on last time before I go on to speak about the birth of Jesus. And that was the question of whether what it means to be in the line or to be the... whether he had to be the specific heir of David. Now, some people take the view that Jesus needed to be and was the direct lineal descendant of David, in the sense that he was the rightful heir, in the sense that Queen Elizabeth II is the rightful heir to the British throne, as it were. And so some take the view, therefore, that through the centuries, that he had the line was such that he was the rightful heir in physical terms. And my thought on that is that I see no need for it to be like that, because the point is that to be the Messiah, you have to be the son of David, you have to be a descendant of David, but I don't think you have to be the specific heir in the sense that we mean it like that. And therefore, I think the right way to look at it is that the Messiah must have two qualifications, really. He must be the in the line of David, but also there's an element of appointment. So therefore, God takes one of the descendants of David and appoints him to be king of Israel. And actually, we see that principle established even with the appointment of Solomon. So the thing is, I know that one commentator I was reading, he said that you had to be in the line coming from Solomon and so forth, you know, through Solomon, Rehoboam, and on it goes. You must be in that line. I don't think that's true. I mean, I don't think so, because even Solomon himself was not in the rightful line, as it were. So I don't know if you're aware, but when Solomon was appointed, because David actually called a great meeting of all his officials, and he announced that Solomon was going to be the next king. And when he did that, Absalom and Adonijah were both still alive. I think probably Amnon was alive. At least those two. Anyway, possibly Amnon as well, were all still alive at that point. Well, they were older than Solomon. They were... the line of succession, if you want to see it in those terms, would not have gone through Solomon. So why then was Solomon chosen? Why did he get the kingship? Because he was appointed. So I think that's the right way to look at it. Therefore, I'm not saying that Jesus wasn't the direct heir in the sense of Queen Elizabeth II. He may have been. I'm just saying he doesn't have to be, because he has to be in the line of David and then be appointed. And I think that's the correct way to look at it. And I just mention that because some of the commentators take the view that he had to be, it had to be the exact rightful heir in the sense that we say that. Anyway, I say that as an aside. So let's go on to look now at verse 18 of chapter 1, the birth of Jesus. It says, verse 18, "Now the birth of Jesus Christ took place in this way. When his mother Mary had been betrothed to Joseph, before they came together, she was found to be with child of the Holy Spirit." Now, let's look at this word betrothed. This event happened during a one-year period while Mary was betrothed to Joseph. And what they used to do, and it's important to understand the ancient Jewish marriage system, because it has implications typologically for the return of Jesus Christ as well. And so they had a 1 year period between what we would call an engagement and then the wedding. Now the point is, what they called a betrothal was a bigger and more formal thing than what we call an engagement. So it's like for us, an engagement is not a final or an irrevocable thing. It doesn't require a divorce to break it or anything like that. The engagement in our society means less than that. It just means this is your intention. this is your plan, you're going to get married to so-and-so, you're engaged to so-and-so. That's not what they meant by it. So when you were betrothed, it was much more formal and a much greater commitment. And the only way you could break a betrothal was by divorce. You had to get a divorce while you were betrothed, you see, even before the wedding day. So it's important to see it in those terms. The other thing, of course, to see, I'll mention this in passing, is that during that year, the betrothal year, the bridegroom, the bride, the future bride, would stay home living with her parents. The bridegroom would be at his house, and he would be building a house for himself and the bride to live in. And so he would come back at a year later, and he would come back and in a procession and come and get the bride and take the bride away with him to his house, do you see? And that's how he would do it. And that matches typologically what Jesus is going to do. We are the bride, we're waiting for him, and he's going to come back and take us to his house. And that's what is going to happen. And the return of Jesus and his how he's going to go about it is based on this marriage system. Or rather, it was set up to reflect what he was going to do. And one of the reasons, of course, of the betrothal year, one of its reasons, one of its purposes, was to make sure that the bride was pure. So therefore, she was away from the bridegroom for that year, and therefore if she became pregnant in that year, then that meant she was not pure, and so she had a whole year to demonstrate that she was a pure bride. And that's what one of its purposes. So the thing then is that during that very year, which has that very purpose, she became pregnant, and Joseph learns of it. It must have become either obvious, or he heard of it, or in some way he got to know about it. But he got to know about it without knowing how or why. So insofar as Mary had been speaking about it, if at all, she had not said how this came about. So maybe she'd said nothing at all and he heard about it from others. Or maybe she'd said she was pregnant but explained nothing about why. I don't know why she said nothing about why. Maybe she felt she wasn't at liberty to explain why. But it would seem clear that she had not said why, because Joseph knew nothing about how this came about. And he made the obvious assumption that she must have been unfaithful to him, which would have been very puzzling to him, because Mary was a person of exemplary character. And he must have been very confused and felt shocked and terribly disappointed. It says in verse 19, it says, "And her husband Joseph, being a just man and unwilling to put her to shame, resolved to divorce her quietly." Now what he could have done was gone and complained about her, and she could under the law of Moses. Remember, the law of Moses is still in operation at this time. Had he reported this, she could have been stoned to death for adultery, with there being obvious proof of adultery because she's expecting. But Joseph didn't want any of that, so he didn't want her to be stoned to death, and he didn't even want her to be put to shame. So he was just going to quietly divorce her without saying anything about it. And bear in mind but the point is then in verse 20, look at this, it says, "But as he considered this," so whilst he was contemplating the divorce at an early stage, it says, "Behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to him in a dream, saying, Joseph, son of David, do not fear to take Mary your wife, for that which is conceived in her is of the Holy Spirit." And then verse 21, "She will bear a son, and you shall call his name Jesus," or Yeshua, "for he will save his people from their sins." Now, I should mention, the word Yeshua, we get the word Jesus, is just the Greek version of Yeshua. And we in English pronounce it Jesus. If you're in France, you pronounce it Yesu. But in Hebrew, the name is Yeshua. And Yeshua is basically Joshua, and it means salvation. So he was called Salvation. That was his name. So in the school register, they would shout out Salvation, and he would shout Present. That was his name. That was his very name, Salvation. That's his real name. So At any rate, Joseph has been told this by an angel of the Lord. Notice it says an angel of the Lord, not the angel of the Lord. When the Bible speaks of the angel of the Lord, it generally means a pre-appearance of Jesus Christ as the second person of the Trinity in bodily human form on the earth. When it speaks of the angel of the Lord, which you may want to look up many, many such references to him in the Old Testament. But here this is an angel. So this is an ordinary angel, albeit perhaps a senior one. It's an angel that comes to make this announcement to Joseph. Now, of course, in Matthew's Gospel, the whole thing is told from the perspective of Joseph. We hear nothing from Mary. It's all told from Joseph's perspective. The angel only speaks to Joseph. Only Joseph's involved. Mary's not involved. In Luke's Gospel, it's the other way around entirely. The angel speaks to Mary. Joseph's not saying anything. Totally from Mary's perspective in Luke's Gospel. But in this Gospel, it's from Joseph's perspective. And so, I should add as well that although he wanted to save disgrace for Mary by divorcing her quietly, by not divorcing her, he brought disgrace on himself. Do you see that? So by continuing to marry her, the automatic assumption that would be made by others, because I don't think they told anybody about any of this. I don't think they went out telling everybody. Well, what's happened is, an angel has appeared to Mary and said this, and an angel appeared to me and said this. I think they would have considered that casting pearls before swine to speak about that, and I don't think they were at liberty to speak about it. So I don't think that was disclosed until Matthew and Luke revealed it years later. So all through these years, Joseph went through the dishonour and brought stigma upon himself by being willing to marry Mary in this way. And so you need to see it in the context. He wasn't, I think, at liberty. At any rate, there's no indication that he ever said anything. So I don't think he was at liberty to say anything. And therefore, it was all unexplained. So the whole thing, people made the natural assumption either that Mary had been unfaithful and been with some other man, or that Joseph had been with her during the betrothal year. Those would be the obvious assumptions that you would make. And those were, I think, the assumptions that people did make. And that's what was said. But Joseph tolerated that. Joseph endured that, which must have been a great burden to him and a great trial to him. Because Joseph is a very, very righteous person, very godly. And so is Mary. So you can imagine from their perspective what they went through to endure that. And not only that, but what Jesus went through in his childhood and in his adulthood as well. Because you'll notice in the Gospels, when he's an adult, one of the insults that people bring to him is when they say, for example, "We know who our father is." Remember? When the insults come from the crowds. Meaning, they've heard the stories about him being illegitimate. So right through his lifetime, he had to bear the stigma of allegedly being illegitimate, when in fact he wasn't. But that was the rumour about him, which they had heard about. And I think it's part of what he had to endure for us. So not only did he endure the cross and so forth, but he endured shame in other ways too. So shame is one of the things that he took upon himself at the cross. He took our sin upon him, but he also took other things. He took all the curses of the world upon himself. He took the shame upon himself, the disgrace, all these things that we have, he had. He knows what it is to be stigmatized, to be disgraced, to have false accusations made about you, rumors spread about you. There's probably little or nothing that you could think of that you could suffer or endure that he hasn't suffered something very similar. And that's one of the things. So, in verse 22, it says, "All this took place to fulfill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet," that means Isaiah. It means Isaiah. And in verse 23 it quotes Isaiah and says, "Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and his name shall be called Emmanuel," which means "God with us." Okay. Now that is a quotation from Isaiah. And you'll be surprised if ever you read the commentaries that acres of print space are devoted to this question of what is meant by the word virgin. These are often the things that academic theologians occupy themselves with. And so one of the reasons why they spend so much time talking about it is because the Hebrew word used in Isaiah, underline the word Isaiah, is Alma, for virgin. That means virgin, but it also has the potential to mean young woman, just a young woman. So there's a small element of ambiguity in Isaiah as to whether this means a virgin or a young woman. A little bit like if you took the word brother, what does the word brother mean? It means brother, but you could argue that it also means like a monk, or it also means a shop steward in a trade union or something like that. You could argue it means a trade unionist, or you could argue it means a monk in a monastery, because that's a possible meaning of the word. Well, likewise, the word Alma in Hebrew means virgin, but is capable of meaning young woman as well. And so many especially liberal commentators, spend a lot of time looking at this as to whether this really needed to be a virgin or just a young woman, you see. But the point is, you could save all that ink and all that paper by just turning to Matthew. And because, you see, what Matthew does, he doesn't use the word Alma from Hebrew. He uses the word Parthenos from Greek. Now, the word Parthenos means virgin, and only that, and means nothing else. So what Matthew does, in one single word, he just squashes flat any debate that might otherwise have been had as to the meaning of this word. So insofar as you might have sought to entertain the idea that maybe Mary would just be a young woman would conceive and bear a son, and that would be the sign. Well, first of all, it's not a very big sign, is it? It's something that's happening all the time, so it's hardly what you'd call surprising or unusual. And secondly, it's not possible for it to mean that, because Matthew completely squashes that idea flat. A great big foot comes down from Matthew and just stamps on that idea and completely crushes it. So there's no point even debating it. And yet, nonetheless, the commentators preoccupy themselves with thoughts like that. But if you believe Matthew is inspired, then Matthew's inspiration gives you the correct meaning of the Hebrew word Alma, which is already plain and obvious anyway, but he completely removes any ambiguity or doubt about that. Okay, so verse 24 of chapter 1. It says, "When Joseph woke from sleep, he did as the angel of the Lord commanded him." So, note, Joseph immediately does what the angel says. There's no arguing, there's no delay, there's no pondering on it. He just immediately, like Mary, who immediately accepted what was said, he doesn't argue. He doesn't even doubt it. Like, remember, Zechariah, the father of John the Baptist, he didn't do much, but he just doubted. He just questioned what the angel was saying to him. Joseph doesn't. He wakes up and he immediately does what is required. But remember how much that cost Joseph. Because remember, at least I think it's reasonable to deduce this from the chapter and from the absence of what is from what's not said. It's reasonable to deduce that Joseph was not at liberty to explain himself to everybody. So he had to go ahead and marry Mary, and notwithstanding all of this. And it says here, he took his wife. Okay, but knew her not until she had borne a son. Okay, now in verse 24, he took his wife. What that means is he broke with convention, because he was meant to wait until the end of the year and then Mary would come into his house. But what he did was he broke with that convention and brought Mary into his house and basically married Mary before the year was up. Okay, but he did not know her in the sexual sense. They had no relations of that kind until Jesus had been born. And so when he was born, they called his name Jesus, which is what Joseph had been told he was to be called. And so, of course, if it had been Joseph's own son, he would have been called after Joseph's father, which we'll come to. I'll come to that in a moment. He would have been called James after Joseph's own father, but he wasn't. He was called Jesus. So let me just address this question from verse 25. But it says, but knew her not until she'd borne a son. Now, this is an issue with many, because within Catholicism in particular, it's believed that Mary and Joseph never consummated their marriage at all. Now, that Mary was ever virgin, you see. That's what they say. Now, if that was the case, if they had never consummated their marriage, they never would have been married. They'd have just been eternally betrothed. And therefore, Jesus would have been brought up by a couple who were just betrothed and not married. Now, in Jewish eyes, and in every country, marriage, the real act of marriage is the consummation of the marriage. Everything else is preparatory to marriage. That's the real act of marriage. That's when marriage really happens. Everything else is simply promising to get married, letting people know that you're getting married, making vows, having a ceremony, and so on. But the real act of marriage is between the couple themselves. If they had not done that, they would have been forever an unmarried couple. Now, for Jesus to be brought up by an unmarried couple would have dishonoured him, and it would have dishonoured them, and it would have been wrong. And so, but quite apart from all that, so first of all, it would have been wrong for them to do that, and Joseph and Mary wouldn't do something wrong. But quite apart from all that, there is no basis whatsoever for thinking that Joseph and Mary lived forever, with no relations between them. There's just no basis for it. But quite apart from saying there is no basis for it, because the Bible says nothing at all to suggest it whatsoever, on the contrary, the Bible plainly states the direct opposite. So in order to believe that Mary was ever virgin, you've got to believe in something that's not in the Bible at all, and totally disbelieve in something that is repeatedly stated in the Bible. You've got to do both. And now let me just go through a few verses which I've drawn together, which we can point to, which show us that Mary and Joseph had other children. And I'll read these out, so you don't need to look them up. I'm going to read them out as I go along. But I'm only going to read out the operative words, not the wider passage. So Matthew 12:46, it says, "While he was still speaking to the people, behold, his mother and his brothers stood outside asking to speak to him." Now, what people in Catholicism say is that brothers there means cousins. Well, it could be taken to mean that, in the same way that it could mean that a group of trade unionists stood outside waiting to talk to him. Or it could mean that a group of monks from a monastery stood outside waiting to speak to him. But how would you know if it meant trade unionists or monks from a monastery? You'd know from the context, wouldn't you? So if it had said, and Jesus went to the trade union shop stewards meeting, and the brothers said to him, "Now then, brother, we need to do this, you know, make these changes in the union," you would know from the context that it meant another meaning of the word brother, wouldn't you? But in the absence of such a context, your default setting would be to assume that the word brother means the plain, obvious, direct meaning of the word, in the absence of something in the context that tells you it's not the obvious meaning. There's nothing whatsoever in the context of that verse that tells you that it means something other than brother. So outside, his mother and brothers are waiting for him, want to speak to him. Then Matthew 13:55-56, it actually names them. And it says, "Is not this the carpenter's son? Is not his mother called Mary? And are not his brothers James and Joseph and Simon and Judas? And are not all his sisters with us?" Now what do we deduce from this? Jesus had four half-brothers. And he had at least two sisters, because it speaks of all his sisters. Well, sounds like more like three sisters or more. But he had at least two, because they're in the plural, and probably three or more. So over the following many years, because Mary got married very young, she was probably only 18 or so when she got married, she went on to have many more children with Joseph. And Interestingly, if you note from that list in Matthew 13, 55 to 56, note the names of the sons. Note the first one name. First one's name is James. Well, if you look back in Matthew's genealogy, in Matthew 1, 16, guess what the father of Joseph, and this is, remember, Matthew's genealogy is Joseph's genealogy, not Mary's. Luke gives you Mary's, Matthew gives you Joseph's. Now note, what is the name of the father of Joseph? His name is Jacob, or Jacob. Now that name means James. So the names Jacob and James are just alternative renderings of the same name. A bit like John and Sean, or do you see? They're just alternatives of the same name. Now, that's why, for example, in the English monarchy, if you speak of the Jacobites, who are the Jacobites? They were supporters of the Stuart line. Who are the Stuart line? Coming from King James. So they were supporters of James as line. James means Jacob. So a supporter of the line of King James is called a Jacobite, not a Jamesite, a Jacobite, because the two names are the same. So my point is this. The first son here is named after Joseph's father. The second son is named after Joseph. Do you see? Now what does that tell you? These are Joseph's own children. Alright? So why would Jesus just happen to have a bunch of cousins who were all named in such a manner as to correspond to the parents of Joseph? Do you see? I mean, and then I won't read it out, but Mark chapter 6 verse 3 deals with the same passage as Matthew 13. And next, John 7, 5, it says, "For even his brothers did not believe in him." Okay? He's talking about his own natural brothers. Some might say, oh no, brothers means the apostles. Or, well, the apostles do believe in him. Do you see? When you try to twist the scripture to force your foot into a size 4 shoe, Cinderella's shoe, you're forcing your foot into a shoe that's too small. Here, if you say, oh no, this means the apostles, well then you've got to believe, well then the apostles didn't believe in him. Well, that's nonsense. They did believe in him. It's not talking about the apostles. It's talking about his natural, physical half-brothers. Okay. Well, let's make that a little clearer. In Acts chapter 1, verse 14, it says, all these, well, first of all, it lists all the apostles. So to remove any element of doubt, it names all the apostles, and then it says, all these with one accord devoted themselves to prayer. That means all the apostles, together with the women and Mary, the mother of Jesus, and with his brothers. So plainly, if you were trying to entertain the idea that the brothers means the apostles, well, it plainly doesn't, because they've just named all the apostles, and then the brothers are something other than that. And then in 1 Corinthians 9, verse 5, it says, "Do we not have the right to be accompanied by a wife as the other apostles and the brothers of the Lord and Cephas?" So it names the apostles and Peter and the brothers of the Lord. Well, plainly the brothers of the Lord are not the apostles. And then in Galatians 1:19 it says, Paul says, "But I saw none of the other apostles except James, the Lord's brother." And that's speaking about James the Just, who's the writer of the book of James in the New Testament. He is Jesus's half-brother, his eldest half-brother, who was named after Joseph's father. And then Jude 1, verse 1. Now Jude, of course, is one of the other half-brothers of Jesus. So they both got to write a book in the New Testament. And Jude, when he's introducing himself, Jude, in his own letter, he doesn't presume to say that I'm a brother of Jesus Christ. So what does he do to tell you who he is? He's too modest to say that he's the brother of Jesus Christ. He says, and he talks of himself, and he says, "A servant of Jesus Christ and brother of James." So he uses a device to tell you who he is, but he doesn't want to be seen to be sort of name-dropping and boasting. So he tells you that he's the brother of James, which he is, but he's also the brother of Jesus Christ. So I go through those because it is such a stumbling block to many, this whole business of Mary and what she was and what she went on to do and what Joseph and she did. And it's really created a sort of roadblock in people's minds that they can't see it. And we need to see that they just lived as an ordinary, normal, perfectly normal married couple from the point when Jesus was born. But until then, they lived at that, from that point in the betrothal. Mary had been with her parents. She moved into Joseph's house, but they did not relate together as man and wife until after Jesus was born. Okay, so let's go on now to look at Matthew chapter 2. And we now have the visit of the wise men. So it says in verse 1, "Now when Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king," that means Herod the great, "behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem saying," right, where is he who was being born king of the Jews? Okay, well, let's look at this. Who were these wise men and how many of them are there? Now, in all your Christmas cards and school nativity plays, you have three wise men, don't you? And we've even given them names, just out of tradition, that no one knows what their names were. But it's assumed that there were three of them. And it's assumed there were three because they gave three gifts. But you see, the British Foreign Office might send a delegation over to some country and bring three gifts, but it doesn't mean that we had three diplomats that went over. They might give three gifts, but there could be 50 diplomats that went over with the gifts. There were three gifts, but that doesn't tell you how many wise men there were. So there were at least three, but quite probably, almost certainly more than three. And think of it. Why would it create such a stir for these wise men to come over? Because they came over to Jerusalem and Herod noticed. Well, if three chaps came to Jerusalem and just checked in to a hotel, and they come across in their little car and they arrive in Jerusalem, who's going to even notice? The clear implication is that a large delegation came. Nobody knows how many, but if you had to think of a number, I would think it would be in over 100 or 200, or so. It was a big number. A large group of these men came searching for the Messiah. So I don't know how many there are, but very probably not just the three. So the image we get from the nativity play and from Christmas cards is an inaccurate one. And so who were they? Well, first of all, they were Gentiles. And they came from the east. So they came somewhere from the east. And they were called Magi. And the word Magi meaning astrologers. But the point is that word is a little misleading, because what we call an astrologer is a follower of the occult and so on. But the word astrology means also astronomy. So there were people who watched the skies and the stars. There were certainly that. And I think most probably what they were is they were men from Babylon, and they were the descendants of those men whom Daniel had led and taught and influenced way back in the book of Daniel. Now remember, Daniel was appointed head over all the wise men in Babylon. And these were all occultists in various ways. They were followers of false religion at the time under Nebuchadnezzar. Now Nebuchadnezzar didn't understand much to begin with, although he ended up writing a chapter 4 of the book of Daniel. Nebuchadnezzar became a believer in the end. But Nebuchadnezzar, when he started off, he didn't know what day it was. He didn't understand anything. He was an occultist. He had all his wise men who were astrologers and occultists and so on. That's how the book of Daniel begins. But Daniel, by virtue of his great ability and wisdom, was appointed head over all those wise men. Now, we don't know this, but I'm just conjecturing, who were these wise men and why did they come and how did they know that this was the time to come? And how did they know that there was anything to come for or what signs to follow? And I think what it was, this is my belief, and I think it's pretty strongly likely to be correct, is that they had been taught by Daniel, or those before them had, and a number of those men in Babylon had become followers of the true God of Israel because of Daniel's influence. And they understood the book of Daniel. They understood Daniel chapter 9. See, you know when the messianic age is going to come. You know when the Messiah will come from the book of Daniel. From chapter 9. It tells you how many years and so forth. From Daniel chapter 9, especially verses 24 to 27. So by looking at those, they would be able to know it's getting ready for the time when Messiah must come. In precisely the same way that Anna and Simeon in the temple knew it must be, the time must be close. Do you see? Well, so did they. So they knew so based on the prophecies of Daniel. So they knew there was going to be a Messiah because the Old Testament is full of it. They knew when it would be because Daniel says. And they knew that there'd be a sign, that there would be a star. And how did they know that? Very probably because Daniel had taught them about Balaam's prophecy from Numbers chapter 24. So Balaam had prophesied, a star shall come forth out of Jacob, you see, in speaking of the coming Messiah. A star shall come forth out of Jacob. Now, the thing is, I believe that they were expecting a star. I think Daniel was expecting a star. Probably Daniel told them that when the time comes, there will be a star. So when the star came, they knew the time has come. Okay? They knew the time was imminent because of Daniel's prophecies anyway. But when the star came, that was like the next pointer that says, it's not imminent, it's happened, he's come. So they will have seen the star at the time when Jesus was born. But bear in mind, they've got to come from the east. So there is a period of delay from when they see the star from the east and they follow the star westward towards Jerusalem, towards Israel. But from there, they're following a star that is just pointing to Israel. And of course, it's pointing to Jerusalem. It's not yet pointing to Bethlehem. We'll come to that in a moment, because they go westward towards Jerusalem, but then 5 miles north of Jerusalem is Bethlehem. So they don't turn north until they get to Jerusalem. Anyway, we're getting ahead of ourselves. So it says they go to Jerusalem, and I think by virtue of the fact that they are such a large party, Herod gets to know about them. So I don't think they are looking out for Herod. They don't want Herod. They're not going looking for Herod. They want to avoid Herod. Herod comes looking for them. And that's one of the reasons why I say there must have been a large party. And Herod notices them. Because Herod himself is aware of the prophecies about the coming Messiah. Many people knew about Daniel. And many, many knew. Just as today, many of us know about the return of Jesus Christ. That doesn't cause people, though, to become actively waiting for him. So the mere fact that people know doesn't mean they actively wait or actively prepare or actively do anything. But Herod knew about the prophecies. He knew that a Messiah was coming. He knew this, and he was paranoid. So he's called Herod the Great, but some would call him Herod the Paranoid, because he was very worried about this coming king. He didn't want this coming king and wanted to kill him. And so they've come to Jerusalem. They've come searching for the king. They know that it's that away. He's coming over that away. Now bear in mind, the star that they followed wasn't permanent. It was coming and going. So the star, they'd followed the star, but then the star stopped. So they followed the direction of the star, but then the star went away. And we'll see shortly that the star comes back. So they say that they've seen his star in the east and have come to follow him, to worship him. Okay, and so that will have been months earlier at least, maybe a year earlier, maybe more. And so it says in verse 3, when Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. So Herod was troubled, and the city was troubled because Herod was troubled. The point is this, that if Herod gets in a temper, you've all got to be worried, because he was a tyrant and would have people put to death for nothing. I mean, the point is, Herod the Great killed at least 3, maybe 4 of his own sons, and he killed at least 1 of his wives. And he did it because he thought they were plotting against him. So if he thought anyone was plotting against him, he'd have them killed. That's why, in relation to King Herod, Caesar Augustus said of him, "It's safer to be Herod's pig than to be his son." And in Greek, the words pig and son sound similar. They're sort of alliterative. And so, and what he meant was, if you were Herod's pig, you'd be safe because he doesn't eat pork, because he's notionally Jewish. He's Idumean, he's an Edomite, but he was notionally converted to Judaism. And he basically bought the throne, and he became king over Israel, but he wasn't really a Jew, he was notionally Jewish. But because he was notionally Jewish, the pig would be safe, but the sons weren't. And that's what the joke that Caesar made about Herod, because he'd heard his reputation. And look, in verse 4 it says, "And assembling all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he, Herod, inquired of them where the Christ was to be born." So he's heard effectively from the wise men that they've seen the star, they've come, they think it's happening. Now he wants to know, well, where will he be born? But interestingly, note this, the chief priests and the scribes, they tell him where he's going to be born. It says, verse 5, "They told him, in Bethlehem of Judea, for so it is written by the prophet." And they're talking about Micah. And it's a reference to Micah chapter 5, verse 2. And in verse 6, they quote it, and it says, "Oh, and you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For from you shall come a ruler who will govern my people Israel." So that's the prophecy about the town of Bethlehem. The Messiah will be born there. And so the thing is this, that the chief priests and the scribes, they knew, the religious men, they knew what the Bible said. But the point is, they did nothing about it. So if they know that Daniel says, it's coming time now, this is the time for Messiah to come, and if they know he's going to be born in Bethlehem, how come these fellows weren't going over to Bethlehem to wait for the Messiah, to meet him, etc.? But they weren't. They were staying parked where they were. They weren't going anywhere. Note, it's people like Anna and Simeon who are acting upon and waiting actively for the prophecies to be fulfilled. They were the ones who were taking it seriously. And so were the wise men who came from wherever, probably Babylon. They were taking the prophecies seriously. And there's a real lesson in this for us, because we likewise have all the Bible prophecy in our hands, but many, many, many people don't take it seriously. They just ignore the Bible prophecy and don't act upon it. What we should be doing is acting upon it, taking it seriously, preparing, getting ready, believing it's going to actually physically happen. That's what we should be doing. And then verse 7 it says, "Then Herod summoned the wise men secretly and ascertained from them what time the star appeared." Okay, now bear in mind, they had seen the star when they were way off, wherever they were, Babylon or somewhere else. They had to come on horseback or camel or whatever, all that distance. They'd have to plan the journey, make the journey over many, many weeks, probably months. It could be quite a long time since they saw the star. And let's address this question as well. What is this star? Because if you look at, again, in the commentaries, you'll see much talk about what people think the star was. And people speak of it being these two planets might have been in alignment or conjunction, or this star or that planet or this thing or that, etc. But the point is, it plainly wasn't a star, as in that kind of a large ball of hydrogen. It wasn't that kind of star. If a star had come and rested over Bethlehem, there would have been no Bethlehem. It would have been vaporized, wouldn't it? We're not talking about an actual star. What we're talking about is a light that looks like a star. But it would have been a very noticeable one, a very unusual one, a very peculiar one. Very different from the stars in the sky, but looking rather like one, but just much brighter and acting differently and travelling in different direction from the stars. So what was the star? Almost certainly the star was the Shekinah glory. It was God's glory shining over the place where Jesus was. If not that, then perhaps it was an angel, or perhaps it was the choir of angels that we read about in the book of Luke. Most probably that God's own Shekinah glory shining, just as it was when the Israelites were led through the wilderness by God's glory. Probably that. So the point was that God's glory, or the angels, or whatever it was, were making that light in the sky to direct people to where Messiah was being born. That's what it means. That's what they saw from Babylon. But of course other people would have seen it, but would have ignored it, or misunderstood it, or paid no attention to it, or just been limp and done nothing about it. It was there to be seen. They acted upon it, others ignored it. And then verse 8 it says, and he, Herod, sent them to Bethlehem, saying, go and search diligently for the child, and when you have found him, bring me word, that I too may come and worship him. Well, that was just a lie. Herod wanted to kill him. He didn't want to worship him. So he sends the wise men off to search for the child. But they go off to Bethlehem, because they now know that Bethlehem is the place where he'll be born. And it says, in verse 9 it says, they set off now. It says, when they had heard the king, they went their way. And lo, the star which they had seen in the east went before them, till it came to rest over the place where the child was. So the star reappears. The star comes back. And the star guides them 5 miles from Jerusalem down to Bethlehem, further south. So now the star is travelling north to south. Which, as I understand it, no real star would ever do that, travelling north to south. That's not the direction of travel they would go in. So when they hit Jerusalem, when they get from Jerusalem to Bethlehem, we're now talking about being probably 1 to 2 years after Jesus was actually born. A significant period of time has gone by, whatever it was, I don't know how long, but a sizable period of time. How do we know that? Well, first of all, for the reasons I've gone through. But also, note, it says, till it came to rest over the place. In the RSV it says place, but the word there means house. So they're no longer in a barn or stable or cave where the animals are. Jesus is no longer in a manger. He's now in a house in Bethlehem. So time has passed. But also, you note, the word child that's used, where the child was. The word used for child is paideion, meaning child. It's not brephos, meaning newborn. So if you, in the maternity unit, the women will bring home their brephos, you know, bring home the brephos in a little shawl or something, bring home the brephos, is a newborn. But a year later, 2 years later, you don't have a brephos, you've got a paideion, you've got a child now. And there he is in his romper suit and in a quite different setup. So you don't call that child a year later a newborn. And that even that word tells you. So the place is different. They're not in the stable anymore. The child is a child now, not a newborn. And so the image that we have from the Christmas cards and the carols and all the rest of it, of the shepherds and the wise men standing round the crib, is a mistake. The shepherds and the wise men never met each other. The shepherds were there on the night of Jesus' birth. They were there at the time. They were there when they saw the stable, the manger. They saw the animals. They saw Joseph and Mary. And they saw the baby born. They saw that. The wise men never saw that. They were never at the stable. They never saw the manger. Never saw that. They came later. Now Joseph and Mary had moved into a house and were living in Bethlehem in a house. And that's when they came. So that's important that you see that. Okay, so verse 10. It says, when they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. And going into the house, verse 11, and going into the house, they saw the child with Mary his mother, and they fell down and worshipped him. So you see, they worshipped him. They were believers. They believed in who he was. They knew what he was, and they believed in him. And the interesting thing is, there were all these people in Israel who were ignoring this. This was happening in Israel, just in Bethlehem. They could have come, but they didn't come. So these men came from elsewhere. Gentiles came to worship him. It says, then, opening their treasures, they offered him gifts, gold and frankincense and myrrh. So what were these gifts? Well, they were symbolic gifts. So gold is a gift symbolizing Jesus' kingship. He's a king. And frankincense, fragrance for his perfect holiness and as a symbol of his deity and sinlessness as well. And myrrh is a symbol of his suffering and death. So, unusual presents to bring. Can you imagine bringing that to some new family and say, I've just brought you this myrrh to symbolize the death and suffering of your child. That's not the way to get yourself, you know, win friends and influence people, is it? But the thing is, these gifts were brought, and they were brought for very specific reasons. But note, you see, in Isaiah 60 verse 6, it speaks about Jesus and his second coming. And it speaks about people bringing him gifts, and they're going to bring him frankincense and gold, but they're not going to bring him myrrh. So in Isaiah 60 verse 6, now that is forward looking. That's coming, the next coming of Messiah, Jesus, King Messiah, when he comes back. There won't be any myrrh. So nobody will bring him myrrh as a gift. They bring him gold and frankincense. So can you see how exact and specific the Bible is? So when he comes back, you don't need to go out shopping for myrrh. He won't be needing any. Gold and frankincense is what people will bring him. Okay. And then it says, and verse 12, and being warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they departed to their own country by another way. So again, they were warned, don't go back to Herod. You can't trust Herod. Don't go. And they go back, and that's when, as we go on now to look, Herod tries to kill Jesus, but they don't want to help him in that. They've discerned his real purpose. Okay, well, I'll stop at that point. We'll carry on in the next talk with what Herod then does.